Hey Optimists, so today's episode is really exciting. I got to speak with the author, tech entrepreneur, crypto CMO and thought leader, Jonathan McDonald, about some of the revelations in his best-selling book, Powered by Change, and ahead of the publication of his forthcoming book, The Rise of Advanced Thought. Jonathan is quite the futurist and almost prophetic in his ability to see round corners to the next game-changing technology. We cover a lot of ground in this, both actual and abstract, and I'm sure you'll find many of his insights to be quite thought-provoking. So enjoy. Hello and welcome to the Chief Executive Optimist, a podcast that delivers resilience recipes for leaders and high performers and helps preserve your sanity and humanity in this time of relentless change. I'm Gareth Hawkins, scale-up investor and principal consultant and coach at Enterprise Insights in London.
So today I'm joined from the Gold Coast of Australia by entrepreneur, coach and Sunday Times best-selling author Jonathan McDonald, whose thought-provoking book Powered by Change provides a 12-point plan for companies looking to harness the external forces of change, becoming more robust, resilient and innovative by building windmills and not walls. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. It's a very early morning for you there and a very late night for me here, but thanks for joining me.
That's all right. Well, basically, if it was slightly earlier for me and slightly later for you, we're pretty much in the same time zone. No. It's all good.
I'm sure we can meet in the middle, there somewhere over Siberia.
Exactly.
So you found yourself in Australia before the UK entered COVID lockdown last year. How are you enjoying the Southern Hemisphere?
I'm enjoying it a lot, actually. My Australian wife has family down here. So yeah, we came down here. But to be honest with you, anywhere in the world, because everyone's online video calling, it makes really no difference. When I was in the UK, I was still Zooming and video calling people who were 3 miles up the road.
The truly globalized entrepreneur. What a time to be alive, eh?
Indeed.
But can you ever see yourself cooking indoors again?
Excellent. I love it. Why not you've got to throw in a bit of a stereotype to start with. There is a huge barbecue culture over here, mate, and actually I've embraced it wholeheartedly, perhaps too much. But the Australians have an extremely entrepreneurial streak.
Oh, absolutely, and they've got so much going for them as a country. There's nothing stopping them really, other than that willingness to embrace change. So, if you can, Jonathan, tell the listeners, for those who might not necessarily be aware of your work, what's your journey so far, so to speak?
In brief, I've spent the last 30 years since leaving school, basically building companies. I'm in my 10th startup now, and my career has ranged from being the youngest ever chairman of the British music industry through to writing 5 books, the most recent of which is a bestseller. My 6th comes out next year, and I've helped various different companies grow, from IKEA, who wrote the foreword to my last book, the Chief Exec, Ministry of Sound, and a lot of stuff with eBay, PayPal, Google, Heineken. But in general, my experience has been one of observation of how our mindset affects our outcome, especially in the times of constant change. And today is the slowest pace of change we'll ever experience. And so I've been enamored by that concept in terms of how we think. And we don't really like to change, really, as humans. We prefer to stay the same, and which is bizarre, bearing in mind the only thing we can predict is that everything changes.
Oh, yes, change is the only constant.
There you go.
So we always look to start our episodes with something that has garnered our attention recently, or that we're considering researching further or investing in or journaling about. So what's on your radar right now, Jonathan?
I think one of the things that's happened in the C19 pandemic is that a lot of people have actually questioned why they do what they do. And there is an almost accidental prioritization of purpose. And so one of the things that I'm observing the most is that we are in a time of increased observation of our own purpose, analyzing why we do what we do. And I think that's en masse a very interesting concept when, there's all this uncertainty going around. And actually, if we have fact that maybe 50% of the workforce will probably never return to an office job. One of the things that working from home does, I'm oversimplifying for the sake of time, but one of the things that remote working does is that it gives us self-reflection time, where we're sitting around the people that we love and care for. And it makes you think, you know, why, for instance, why would I spend 9 hours or 10 hours on Zoom calls with people that I wouldn't cross the road for if they were bleeding? What is this really what I want to do with my life? And I think that's a brilliant moment of introspection that I'm noticing.
Yeah, there's definitely an evolving awareness, I think, as people are getting more, as I've termed it, zoomed out over the last 12, 18 months, starting to prompt a kind of reevaluation of what's important in their world. And rightly so. I think the work-life balance was overdue, a rebalancing. So now that we have all this technology available, and hopefully we have more flexibility about the locations in which we work, and a greater, hopefully, respect and understanding from employers, maybe it's time that people get a bit of time back. And we, as Brits, we're not known for being the most productive in terms of return on man hours. So maybe this will be a catalyst to change that. Let's hope. So on my radar this week, I've been on this crypto tip for the last couple of months and have followed the roller coaster of Ethereum, etc. But as I've looked past the sort of speculative value stores like Bitcoin and potentially Ethereum, I've stumbled over Cardano, which is the token ADA, ADA, and Celo, CELO, both of whom seem to be more egalitarian networks aimed at trying to democratize the availability of currency and the availability of capital and access to public services in the sort of third world, which, if you look at Charles Hoskinson, who's the one of the founders and spokespeople of Cardano, he and his team at IOHK and the wider dev community are doing some fantastic things on taking what Ethereum purported to do, but making it lighter weight, more versatile, lower cost, and generally, I think, more democratic. And Celo actually takes that one step further and puts it into a format where your crypto wallet is actually your mobile phone number. Can you think about how powerful that would be?
Yeah, I mean, there's an even bigger change coming, actually, and it's called Minima, M-I-N-I-M-A. And so Minima is actually next. So the I've been in the crypto world since the beginning, actually 10 years before the beginning. In the late 90s, us cryptographers were very interested in revolutionizing societies and currencies and rebalancing the capitalist worlds. And that then became a paper called B-Money in 1998 and became Bitcoin in 2008. And so I've been involved since then. But what's next is actually Minima. Let me give you a very short rundown of that. Brilliant that you mentioned Celo and Cardano. But the truth is that every blockchain in the world has centralized components. And whilst there's centralized components, there are attack vectors, not only making them less resilient for security reasons, but also having control elements where people can game the system. And 50% of Bitcoin is mined by 5 Chinese mining farms. With Celo and with ADA, you have points of centralization, miners and producers and block validators, which are very, very few computers running, which essentially is like a semi-decentralized world where it looks democratic from the outside, but it's democratic up to the point where there's the control mechanism. What Minima will do when it launches is actually create the only completely decentralized blockchain, and which means that every single human being running a node on their mobile phone. So as you said, that the wallet of Celo is your mobile number. Well, actually, the one step further than that is every person running a mobile device will actually be running a node on the network. To put that in context, Bitcoin has 11,000 nodes. With Minima, there'll be 1 million or 2 million or even more in the future nodes, which will make it the most decentralized network in the entire world. And so that then will rebalance the landscape significantly, because at the moment, the public are becoming aware of things that seem theoretically interesting. But what the public aren't aware of is, A, the huge energy consumption drain of all of the tokens we've mentioned, other than Minima, because that's actually, if it's completely decentralized, there's no energy, that the energy is the same as running a mobile app. But secondly, that to be fair and democratic and collaborative, every single node must be equal. It can't be, every single node apart from these three, that's not actually democratic. So anyway, that's something that I've noticed. And I'm to be fully transparent, I've been helping, you know, the guys behind Minima for a while.
Minima, is it proof of work or proof of stake?
Proof of work, and the with a difference. So proof of work, it's a completely pre-mined blockchain. So there's no new mining, and that's one of the reasons why it's able to be decentralized completely. So every single node on the network is equal and fair, and the blockchain is already pre-mined with 1 billion coins. I think that we will eventually realize that sustainability is absolutely mandatory in blockchains. Democracy and equality and collaboration isn't a punchline. And at the moment, every single blockchain in the world is punchlining and taglining their fairness and human-based approach. And the veil will gradually be lifted over the next 6 to 10 months. That's something which I'm glad the public will eventually become aware of. Anyone can go to Minima .global and actually be part of the community. In fact, there'll be incentives to even run nodes.
It doesn't reconcile with ESG values of today, does it? If on the one hand these asset classes are burning, you know, inordinate amounts of hydrocarbons to achieve the production of their or the validation of their transactions, so Minima is more of a proximity based competition, so much as if you're nearest to where the transaction needs to be validated, like Helium to some extent.
No, Minima is a totally different concept. I would just recommend everyone goes to Minima Global and clicks on the white paper. So it's not a proximity based thing like Helium. It is a total, complete decentralized blockchain, pre-mined, running on every single person's phone.
Yeah, fantastic. So Hal Linney is celebrating from beyond. Cool. All right. Well, yeah, so enough about crypto. Thanks very much for that. Minima.global. I'll go check it out and read the white paper. So let's plow into the main topic of this episode, which is to explore or to exploit. And in your book, Powered by Change, you go to great lengths to explain that it's a paradox that between exploitation of an existing innovation and exploration of the new. Maybe you could go into a bit more detail for the listeners and give some examples.
Sure. So what we have in businesses is we have an asset that we're exploiting, be that a product or a service or a solution that we have on the marketplace. And we exploit that. We not in an exploitative way, but we use that as our growth mechanism we double down on what it is that we're selling or producing, manufacturing, distribution. And what we have at the same time is it's almost a paradox to then be exploring the new at the same time. So almost thinking in, as Kahneman would say, fast and slow. So we have the current exploitation of our assets and the need to explore the new horizons. A bit like an oil tanker that's moving relatively slow versus a speedboat that can explore the horizons and report back. And so businesses have this paradox because they have to do both at the same time, whereas actually business as usual takes up 100% of the energy. So if you look at cost benefit, it seems that exploring the new is very speculative and quite costly versus exploiting the existing being quite stable and more certain and less costly. So it's a real challenge. And the majority of companies I've met do struggle with that. And we do as humans. Thinking about new stuff is quite unusual for us. We tend to read the same articles. We tend to go to the same places, eat the same food. You know, out of the 70 to 80,000 thoughts per day that we think, about 90% of them are the same as the day before. And so we as humans are on repeat cycles. And so that's where we need to be powered by change, move ourselves out of those comfort zones and remember the importance of exploration and trying, testing, learning and improving in a cyclical way.
I wonder if it's also, and this is just a thought experiment, but I wonder if it's also a sort of fear of the capital required to do R&D, et cetera, in developing, exploring a new innovation, which arguably is a little short-sighted, because I think you cite an INSEAD study that in your book, which talks about the relative profitability of sort of new innovations that come through exploration, which obviously are arguably not mature, commodified, low margin opportunities, but how that stacks up against percentages of revenues. Does that bear out?
Absolutely. In rough terms, you know, 20% of the growth comes from about 80% of the activities, the standard activities, and 80% of the growth comes from the 20% of new innovative explorative activities. So if you look at it mathematically, we are duty bound to program in a speculative space of testing and learning and improving to succeed. And in fact, empirically, there are the biggest companies in the world, the fastest growing companies in the world. Take Procter & Gamble, the biggest branding company in the world. They spend 40% of their time and money and therefore and energy resources testing innovations that are brand new. Now, some people might be listening or watching this saying, well, that's all well and good, but I haven't got the time to do new things, to test new things. I haven't got the money to test whether or not it's going to work. But if we can make a non-emotional analysis of where we're spending time and energy and then map that as to what it's giving us, I think we'll find that we do actually have some surplus that can be used, even if it's minor and even if it's just mental rather than financial. So if we create an attention management matrix in our head, let's say, and we have two axes, on the vertical axis we have what it gives in terms of what we get from stuff we do. Maybe it's financial returns or emotional returns or energy returns or whatever it is on the vertical. On the horizontal, we have what it takes in terms of how much it costs us, how much it needs of our energy resources to expend. And in terms of what it gives and what it takes, if you imagine that grid, then we can actually map in terms of a 2x2, kind of four blocks inside that grid. We have on the bottom left-hand side something that doesn't really cost us very much or take very much to do, but it doesn't really return very much either. You know, that's kind of stuff that we need to minimize. Above that, we have something that doesn't cost very much or take very much, but it actually gives us a huge return. Well, that's something that we'd want to maximize. Or on the far right-hand side, if we've got something that costs us a load and takes a lot of time and energy and resources, but doesn't actually give us very much, well, we need to avoid that. And on the top right-hand side, we've got things that cost a lot or take a lot and need a lot, but actually do return a lot, and we need to apply ourselves to those things. And if we can apply ourselves to those things, it becomes easier and less costly and less time, energy drain, and it moves over to the left, the top left, which is our maximize box. And so if you map everything you do in a day and every penny you spend and into which of those four boxes that expenditure, that energy, that payment is going to, what everyone I've ever met has found is that they're spending a significant amount of time and energy and money on things that don't return very much. We only actually get out what we put in. And if nothing changes, then nothing changes. And it's really basic, and it's certainly not rocket science, but it's brilliant that there's so many opportunities for people to grow if they want to.
Modern day Darwinism, though, surely. I mean, isn't this the equivalent with, you know, all of our basic needs catered for? Is this not just the survival of the fittest now, but it's the perhaps the those who attribute enough of their time to rewarding things versus those who are apathetic towards that sort of thing? I mean, I, for one, am all about that quadrant that is minimum input, maximum reward. Just doesn't always correlate with how it seems I spend my time.
Well, indeed. And that's probably because you spend your time on the top, more in the top right, and most people do, which is stuff that actually takes quite a lot of time and energy, but it does give you a lot, but it just takes quite a lot to get there. And that's where people who are trying live. We live on the top right. And eventually the ideology is to make that easier and easier and easier so that we actually spend less energy. And I certainly have found it a challenge to keep practicing things, to get things over to the top left, where we expend a little, but we get a lot. What I do have found easier, to be honest, for me, is to eliminate the things that were taking a lot and give me a little. And I've been quite ruthless with my life on that. I have moved myself out of that funk. And I'm glad to spend time only with nice people as much as I humanly possibly can, and doing things that I get a return from, one of which is speaking to smart people like you.
Thanks. Well, unfortunate juxtaposition, but I was going to remind you not to forget about the sociopaths that also steal your time. I wouldn't be doing justice to this podcast or the values that this podcast expounds if I didn't just tip a wink to the fact that actually there is one good reason to spend some time in that maximum effort and minimum financial return quadrant, and that's where you're doing charitable activities or paying for doing pro bono mentoring, et cetera, which is how I find myself spending a fair bit of my time these recent months, and I'm enjoying the outcomes, but not necessarily the financial rewards. But there's a place for me beyond, one hopes.
Yes. And also remember that what you get doesn't need to be money. What you get can be positive energy. It can be good feeling. It can be feeling altruistically worth it. So that actually is still a high return. In fact, some could argue that's a higher return than income. So let's not for one moment think that just because we're not getting any money for it, it doesn't actually have a great return. Quite the opposite.
So let's call it the utility, however we choose to value that.
Indeed, which is why I was caveating strongly by saying what we get in terms of time, energy, money, resources, good feeling, it's all encompassing.
I love that. Yeah, great stuff. So just returning to the analogy that you have in Power by Change around the oil tanker versus the speedboat. Could you draw any particular examples without betraying any confidence, but any examples that the listeners might be able to relate to?
Totally. I think if we look at car companies who have been forced somewhat unwillingly to become more sustainable car manufacturers, one of the things that I've really observed over time is that some companies, such as Toyota, actually were really, really early in experimenting with green energy, way earlier than most. And that's an example of a company that could have absolutely, giant manufacturer, global presence, could have just carried on making Toyota Hiluxes, for forever. But at the same time as exploiting the current, what they did was, we're talking decades ago, started exploring in the green energy space. So that's an example of what really worked. I remember speaking to a McDonald's restaurant in Chicago, and I said, this is the time now for McDonald's restaurant to explore the territories of vegetarian dishes and healthy food and so forth. And they were wholeheartedly disinterested. And then what happened over the next few years is that certain chains became way more popular, Leon being one of them, and others that basically stole the march of fast food that isn't bad for you. And so now, of course, McDonald's have scrambled to try and catch up. There's now veggie wraps and the salad rolls and stuff like that. And they are really late to the game.
They did acquire Pret a Manger, or a controlling share in it, quite early in its evolution.
Yeah, that was actually an innovation in terms of supply chain. So in terms of logistics, when you walk up to the counter, the speed of service is actually the McDonald's logistics system. And that's done by a range of predictive analytics and simulation machines behind the scenes. So they actually know per minute what's likely to be purchased, and they have an ability to create pre-create orders that are just around the corner. What was interesting, with no disrespect to McDonald's, and this is just an anecdote, which is not any comment on their, certainly not slanderous to their staff, but one of the things I found very interesting was when I arrived every single one of the members of staff in the senior team were extremely healthy, very clear skin. I don't think any of them had touched a piece of junk food for years. The cafeteria sold only beautifully vegan, plant-based food. And I did wonder to myself, would you not, if you were creating food in an organization, would you not want to create the type of food that you would eat? And I asked the chief exec at the time, who's no longer the chief exec, I raised this point. I said, you know, does it not seem a bit ironic that what you're creating here isn't something that you would touch? And he said, we sell shit food to people who don't know better.
Oh, that's why he's not the CEO anymore then. But it is good to see now that they are speaking as a vibrant vegan myself, who has actually not been in a McDonald's for probably 4 or 5 years, to be frank. Yeah, although I hear it's good. But yeah, they're now embarking on Beyond Meat and meat-free burgers, which I guess it must have suddenly become cost-effective to do so because of the way that Beyond Meat have scaled their offering.
Yes. And I think that what happens with an oil tanker speedboat analogy is that eventually, when other oil tankers are acting far more harmoniously with speedboats and they're stealing your market share or your ocean share, you eventually realize the logic. And I wish that companies would be more proactive, more like Toyota, and actually put in their speedboat mechanics early doors. But the majority wait until the market share has slipped, the profitability has collapsed, and they then have to change. And this is the beauty of change, is that you either choose to change or you have to change. And if you don't choose to change, eventually you have to. And it's harder because you didn't choose to.
Well, if you're a corporation, you deal with that by buying someone with who is on trend and has got that idea.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook's a great example of that. You know, Facebook with WhatsApp, Facebook with Instagram. These purchases are the way of innovating. It's innovating through purchase. That's a negative vortex, however. You can never actually catch your own tail. They bought Instagram and then suddenly Snapchat comes. And Snap had no intention of selling to Facebook. And even if they had, then they'd have realized at that moment TikTok's there. And by the time that, let's say, Facebook would have caught up with TikTok, there'd be something else. And it never stops. So buying innovation is a... In a fickle space of teenage consumption that changes with the wind is the least strategic way of spending money.
Yeah, I mean, someone should tell that to AT&T, though, who seem to be buying all of the late era technology on the downward sort of trend of its arc. They seem to have made a habit of it.
They did. But then again, what I'm enamored by is Google's purchase of Motorola and now actually the Moto Android phones are fantastic. And then the Moto G8 is probably one of the best Android phones out. It's going to cost you very little and be very powerful. The Motorola G8 is actually up there, which I love, the fact that they were on their ass and now they're, you know. Maybe underdogs can club together and create an overdog. From, you know, how many underdogs does it take to create an overdog? I don't know. Let's see if AT&T manage that.
Yeah, I think as we get more collegiate and collaborative in business, more around the open source development. I mean, very similar to what we talked about with the crypto earlier. You know, like-minded individuals putting their not insubstantial talents to a greater good. Yeah, maybe that's possible. I'm just happy to see someone's revived the flip phone because, you know, I missed that.
Me too. I love everything about the flip phone, not least that your screen, the most valuable part of the phone, or the most fragile part of the phone, is encapsulated. I mean, logically, it makes sense to have flip phones.
Yeah, and you feel like a character out of Star Trek every time you answer a call.
All right, that's the second benefit.
So, getting back to the oil tankers and the speedboats that are dancing around them, why is it, do you think, in your experience, why is it that so many established companies have this tendency more towards the oil tanker? Why are they blind often to the benefits of exploration beyond the consumer packaged goods market that you mentioned earlier in P&G?
I think the majority of people have a And I'm one of them. I think most humans have a comfort zone that they would prefer to stay within. But if we look at in terms of what James Clear says in Atomic Habits, which is a great book, he speaks of the four laws of behavior change. And inside Atomic Habits, these four are cue, craving, response, and reward. And so if we think about that split out into bits, there's the cue that is the trigger, essentially, of for instance, we walk past a donut shop and think, oh, that's the smell of the donut. The craving then kicks in saying, I love donuts, I want to get a donut. The response then is we tend to sleepwalk into and then just find ourselves eating a donut and not realizing what happened. However, as Viktor Frankl would say, there's a choice of response in everything that we do. And then we have reward, which is based on the sense of utility that we have got from our chosen response based on the craving that was started by the cue. So in terms of behavioral change, for a business, for instance, despite our comfort zone attachment, if we think of the cue, craving, response, reward, behavior change needed for us to actually adopt a more exploratory mindset, the cue would be something's changing in the environment. We have a craving which needs to be more opportunistic for us to then choose our response to be something which is proactive. And then the reward is that we're ahead of the curve. So let's take Amazon, for instance. The cue was, well, we are at the moment the world's largest online book retailer of physical books. But there is this inherent internet capability that surely is going to mean that this could end up being e-ink or e-books to some extent, and that will wipe out our market. Therefore, the craving that happened after that cue was, well, we want to maintain market share. So the response was, well, rather than wait for the innovation to disrupt us, we're going to create the innovation ourselves, hence Kindle. And so that's an example of the cue, craving, response, reward being different. And every company, being a one-person company through to a multi-million person company such as Walmart with 2.5 million employees, the cues, cravings, responses, and rewards are still our opportunity to change our behavior. Seeing what's out there, what's really happening, becoming aware, and then using that as a force to propel ourselves rather than saying, I'm going to build a wall and hope that the change passes.
I really like how you've overlaid the Atomic Habits four laws there onto Power by Change. I guess to extrapolate your point, to be truly powered by change, you are actively looking for those cues. You are trying to read ahead and spot the trends early so that you can be the first person to or first company to innovate a Kindle or the equivalent in your market.
Indeed. Spot on. That's it. It's a simple lesson. Powered by Change is essentially a collection of non-rocket science observations and methodologies that the world's fastest growing companies, big and small, have applied.
So you mentioned Pareto earlier, and he was onto something, definitely. But in the context of exploration versus exploitation, what should the ideal balance of those two be? Is it 80-20 or 20-80, or is there, in your experience, a better ratio?
Yeah, so in poweredbychange.com, the framework has kind of suggests that if you have less than 10% of your activities in an exploratory way, then you are very much more oil tanker than speedboat to a problematic extent. If you didn't have to worry about money, what would you do? If we can spend time, maybe just 1 hour in 10 hours, thinking on those lines, what happens is our brains start churning new innovative thoughts by mistake. And part of ourselves becomes this speedboat, this what if. The truth of the matter is that once we actually start creating thought patterns around that, we start epigenetically becoming that a bit. Our body doesn't know the difference between something we've experienced and something we think we've experienced. So if we start actually thinking, for instance, that we are losing weight, believe it or not, our body starts metabolizing differently. If we start thinking that we are being more innovative and actually starting to come up with creative ideas, you actually start to become more creative. And that's the wondrous thing about our minds. We can actually change our habitual patterns by thinking. say you're trying to give up smoking and someone offers you a cigarette in a beer garden. And there's two different types of people. There's the person that says, no thanks, I'm trying to quit. They still identify with being a smoker, which means that their journey of trying to quit is really, really, really hard. And the other person says, no thanks, I don't smoke. What they've done, they've actually biologically started to tune themselves to not be a smoker. Their journey to give up smoking is monumental, exponentially greater in chances than the person who says, no thanks, I'm trying to quit. And that makes a giant difference. We can do that in business in terms of whether we think we're innovative, we think we're entrepreneurial, or think we're creative. If we actually think we are, then bingo, it turns out we actually start to be.
And as your platform, poweredbychange.com, starts with the visualizing of the outcomes that businesses and leaders want, at risk of straying a little bit too close to the law of attraction and the Napoleon Hill and the secret, which is, you know, not where my heart and mind goes, but I'm certainly attracted to visioning and the power of positive thought. And I think that every leader has to have that at their core. In order to have a successful journey, you have to be able to visualize your destination.
Totally. And by the way, with no disrespect to Rhonda Byrne or her lawyers listening, that it's a total nonsense to think that because you have put your mind to getting a gold Rolex, then suddenly a gold Rolex will arrive in your life. That's BS. And it's dangerous for people to think that that's the way the universe works. And it's a shame that people have attached themselves to that level of absolute nonsense. The truth is that if you actually have an aspirational goal of having a gold Rolex and you work strategically backwards as to what it would take to do that, and then you execute it, then you end up with a gold Rolex. That's not magic. It's effort.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of books that are, the root of all evil in regards to how capitalism has dominated, perhaps in the wrong sense. One for me is probably Atlas Shrugged, and if you've read it, but more pertinent to this conversation, Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill, has far too much merit attached to that for a man who in his own lifetime, do your own research, was caught with his hand in the till on more than one occasion and actually set up a school named after a president and fleeced the investors. So is that a man we want to emulate? I'm not sure.
Exactly right. And I think that I love the fact that you mentioned DYOR, the do your own research. Actually, in general, I think we could do as a human race with a lot more inquisition and a lot more study and a lot more reason. I'm ashamed that around 2,000, 3,000 years ago, we started to deprioritize people who sought reason and we started to criminalize them and in some case murder them in Socrates' case. And it's a real shame that somewhere down the line we started to as structures, especially the Roman Empire, started to try and move the power away from people who sought reason and actually said and put in place constructs, one of which is capitalism, so you don't need to work out why, it just is. And as I said in my TED talk, the 2013 TED talk in Portugal, I start by saying throughout history, the most powerful way of controlling humanity is to limit its access to information. What we need to do to regain the sovereignty of our intellect is to stop outsourcing things to search engines and be more creative and inquisitive. And yes, I'm not saying don't use search engines. What I'm saying is that if we don't know an answer for something, our journey to find that answer should not be just two clicks of a keyboard. It should actually be trying to work out why. Because what we tend to do is, oh, this person thinks that that's not any good. Therefore, you know, Simon Sinek watched my 2010 TED Talk and then wrote a book called Start With Why, based on the actual TED Talk, and became a best-selling author from my 2010 TED Talk. Totally derivative. And the reason why I have absolutely no moral nor legal claim or concern about that is because everything I said in my 2010 TED Talk is derivative of Aristotle. There's no such thing as as good and bad. All there is how we interpret it. But we have to be creatively curious to look into our own reasoning rather than just assume that someone else's thoughts are right.
Yeah, I completely agree. And actually, if we extrapolate that trend, you end up with, unfortunately, the algorithmic news feed of self-perpetuating, sometimes misleading groupthink beliefs that, effectively close a door to independent thought. Poor old Socrates, he could have given us a heads up, but it didn't stop it happening again 1,500 years later or so when all the books were burnt in the Dark Ages, eh? So they were probably due another complete blackout.
Well, without being too fatalistic, are we not inside one? I think where we definitely have arrived at is what is likely to be some form of philosophical revolution. I think we will find that the next generation handle this world in a far different way than our playing with fire version. And since the dawn of innovation, since arguably the first innovation was fire on demand, but the first thing we did when we discovered we could create these sparks was accidentally burn ourselves in the construct of trying to warm our caves. We burnt our entire family. But then we realized we could warm food and it made us less ill and easier to digest. So what we've done with technology in the last 15, 20, 30, 40 years is we've played with fire. We're burning ourselves. We use free tools that actually exploit our private information, and we still adore them. And there's all this fire building and fire burning. And the next generation are aware of that fire. The next generation will warm the caves. This generation have burnt the families.
We keep coming back to this evolution principle. I didn't expect it to be such a common thread in this chat we're having, but it seems to be all roads leading to this, which is exciting. So I want to turn attention just quickly to the platform. You mentioned it. We've teased it out, but I think we need to have a bit of a deep dive into poweredbychange.com. You have coached a multitude of companies on the journey over the last couple of decades, and you've recently launched this platform, which is built around the precepts of your book. I found it transformational, both for executive coaching to leaders and more traditionally aligned with the content of your book, the business coaching of companies. But I've been amazed at how you've applied that to the personal journey of a leader. What led you to do this?
My main driver was that I wasn't able to watch emails coming into my inbox repeatedly of people, individuals saying, "We didn't realize that this was going to happen. Please help us do X, Y, and Z." Or how we've noticed that you've mentioned about these companies on stage doing X, Y, and Z, but we can't do that because we are, and then insert limiting belief there. After a period of time, especially with poweredbychange.com as a platform, the book certainly is, but that aside, after a period of time, I realized that I had to operationalize my advice and my observations and the frameworks that people use productively. And I managed to find a brilliant program designer who then, and actually, to be honest, she was a large part of this being operationalized, because I originally was like, the book's done, the book's out there. And so I think the motivation is that, certainly not from a financial perspective. My ambition with Powered by Change is that it is one part of the legacy that I'm leaving on this earth. And without being too dramatic about it, approaching the second half of my life, let's say, touch wood, everything I do now is more about what I'm leaving behind. Books are static objects and two-dimensional, whereas an online platform is a three-dimensional dynamic object, which is constantly being added to over time. And whilst I have breath in my body, poweredbychange.com will be, from my perspective as the author and advisor to it, I will try and add to it. And my ambition is to build more and more thinking into it from new experiences and other thinkers, so that it becomes just one of many, admittedly, a dynamic tool that that can help people.
Yeah, and that resonates with me, that legacy piece. Having followed a journey where, you know, I've crystallized the wealth, if you will, of the business that I spent years building with others, and now it's very much about what we leave behind. I do think about the world of the future that my young son is growing up in, and I want to shape some part of that and make it a better place for him and his generation. And is it the Hindu religion that says that the only thing that survives you is the reputation and the things that you create during your lifetime?
I think there's many religions that have links to that. And one of my favorite Greek proverbs, I'd say, is that a society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they shall never sit in.
I think we should just end the podcast there, to be honest, John. That's mind blown.
Mic drop.
the platform is aimed at leaders and helping leaders to visualize and track and sculpt their journey and the journey that they take their businesses on, being accompanied on that journey by a coach. And it's very much a platform that respects the role of the coach. And of course, in your career path, you have been a very active coach and mentor. What are your thoughts on the power of a good coach and the benefits to leaders of starting to work with a coach?
I think that every powerful person, every person who's stepped into their own power, has done it with the guidance of others. And I think the healthiest people ask for help. I've been a coach for the chief exec of IKEA off and on for many, many years. And helping him grow the company from 30 to 40 billion euros. But I've also helped people grow from a $1 company to $50 million valuation. If one were to find a coach that they wanted to work with, it would be wise to look at a coach with a rounded, holistic view of things. And what you have specifically, Gareth, is that you have a breadth of understanding of the world, which ranges from the Eastern philosophies to the Western commercial methodologies. And from your experience as an entrepreneur and a business person, but also studied academic-based business background as well from the MBA side of things, I think you have what I would class as the 360-degree coaching capacity, far greater than I've ever achieved. And you are, without a shadow of a doubt, an exemplary coach. And business professional in general. And the more people that there are with your capacity in the world, the better everyone's success will be.
Jonathan, you humble me. The feeling is absolutely likewise. And if I can be half of the person that you are, I'll have done well. So thank you for your high praise. It means a lot. But it doesn't stop me asking for help. And the foundation of humanity is in humility. We could all, I think, do with reaching out for that helping hand along the road. So how do coaches get involved with Powered by Change? Maybe give us a bit of an update for fellow coaches listening as to how they can make use of the platform for their clients.
Well, Gareth, hopefully alongside this, you'll give them a link that will then give you, if you're listening to this, access to a 3-month trial. You can get accredited as a Powered by Change coach. The accreditation program is free. If it sits with you to be accredited as a Powered by Change coach, use that within the rest of your armory, then that's great. If you then want to continue and pay for the coach's license, it's nominal. And during that month's accreditation, you can schedule calls with me once a week personally. You'll see a little calendar thing. I'd be honoured to help you on your journey as well.
So there's a link in the show notes, or at least there will be now. You've prompted me to make sure there is. And there is a no-risk trial for people to get up and running and experience the platform and get the accreditation. I have done it myself and wholeheartedly recommend it. And I think it's a great addition to any serious coach's toolkit. So try it. You might like it. So I'm hugely inspired, as always, from talking to you. And like me and many of our listeners, you clearly come across as being committed to helping others to reach their full potential and to responsibly scale their businesses and achieve the success that they deserve. So fast forward with me, if you will, for 10 years' time, when the innovations of the companies that you've worked with and that we work with have permeated our lives and become commonplace. What are your hopes for that world of tomorrow, the world of our children?
I hope that the world of our children is one of self-awareness and abundance. I think an awareness of the difference between our thoughts and who we actually are as an identity would be an amazing outcome. If we could separate the heuristics and biases to who we are and not think that our fear defines us, or that our guilt defines us, or our past defines us, or our hoped future defines us. If we can decouple those contexts in the future, if our future generation is able to separate those contexts, then they will be a healthier society. If the future generation can realize that that there's no such thing, no construct of the future, all there is moments of this moment, and those two things in harmony, in concert, would be encapsulated with a future generation's drive for fulfillment and contentment in life rather than materialistic gain. And that doesn't mean that ambition should stop. It just means that what we seek is from a position of all upside. That realism, without greed and without entitlement, would be a brilliant future for our next generations.
So unshackled by coveting material gains, enlightened through positive collaborative thought. It might all be possible in future generations. And, you know, you mentioned time, which is obviously a human construct. I'm sure in generations to come, it will be commonplace for us to think in a sort of timeless fashion. I share those hopes for the future. It was very inspiring, as always. I thank you for that contribution and for all that you've said on this podcast today, Jonathan. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I hope that we get the chance to do so again in the future. And I'm going to go and start my Powered by Change journey right now. And I encourage others to do the same.
Awesome. Thanks, Gareth.
We hope you found today's episode of value. If you did, please click the subscribe button in your preferred podcast platform so that you receive our future episodes automatically. Meanwhile, in our next episode, I'll be speaking with Dave Clarkson, a co-founder of Investors in Community and a founder of the Family Business Network. We'll be discussing measurable CSR and the five ways of charitable giving pursued by community-conscious companies. If you'd like to join our discussion or recommend a guest for a future episode, please reach out on social media. I'm at GPG Hawkins on Twitter. I'm also on LinkedIn, and you can email me at podcast@ceoptimist.com. Until then, remember to live with intention, make choices based on your values, and not let the choices of other people define you.